Welcome to the Literary Escape Podcast, the only podcast that serves both readers and authors of historical Christian romance. We read, discuss, review, and rate books in this unique romance subgenre, and sprinkle in a few contemporary Christian suspense books. Authors, we bring you inside tips and tricks from those who have gone before you. Then we bring both readers and authors together for fun-filled live Q&As. Literary Escape is the one-stop shop for both readers and authors to connect, learn, and grow together. Let's dive into this adventurous episode. Thanks to many of you, we are making our way to our goal of selling 135 paperbacks or audiobooks by March 15th. We only need 80 more paperbacks or audiobooks sold to reach that goal, so be sure to send your friends over to literaryescape.com/shop to get their copy today. With your help, we can make this happen. Tomorrow, I will host the online book club extravaganza from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will chat and play bingo and have some door prizes. It's not too late to sign up. If you plan to attend the online event, just complete the RSVP form so that I can send you the link to join. And finally, when you visit literaryescape.com/events, you will find all our coffee and books events for 2025. We have some incredible authors coming to chat with you this year, and these are free events. You just need to RSVP to get the link to join each chat. Our first event is on Tuesday, February 25th, that's next Tuesday, from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Join authors Liz Tolsma, Lynn Blackburn, Sarah Sundin, and Sarah Turnquist for an hour of book talk. That's it for announcements. In today's episode, we will talk with author Beth White about her Gulf Coast Chronicles series. Beth grew up in the South, specifically North Mississippi, which has a rich tradition of fostering writers, storytellers, and musicians. She is fond of both music and literature, and she has recently retired from teaching chorus and piano in an inner-city public high school. You can learn more about Beth and her books at bethwhite.net. Now let's dive into this exciting author chat. So we are excited to have Beth White here with us today. She is the author of the Gulf Coast Chronicles, which we have been talking about over the past 3 weeks. We've been sharing each book in that series. So welcome, Beth. We're so excited to have you here with us today.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
I will say your series caused a lot of chatter on our text group that we have for the book club, just trying to follow all of your family members, the family tree. So I know I'm kind of skipping around in the questions I gave you, but can you just share really quickly how you came up with the family trees? It's a bit complex.
Yeah, it's somewhat accidental and somewhat on purpose. If you don't mind, I'm going to back up to your first and fourth questions because this kind of leads into this.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Because the question about why is there so much time lapse between the first two books and what was the inspiration for the book, those questions tie into this whole family tree.
Right. Okay, let's start there.
So the idea for writing a series of this type is sort of a relaunch, spinoff series concept that I loved with a writer named Elsworth Thayne, who is a British American author who published during the 1940s and 1950s. One of my church librarians clued me into this series. It's called the Williamsburg series. And it's the first couple of books are set in Williamsburg, Virginia. And then it involves a couple of major families who are all tied in through marriage, through friendship, through service in war, through the community, and interacting with real American historical people, George Washington, Sam Adams, and et cetera, all the founding fathers, and then major journalists and military characters of the different time periods of the different books. It's a 7-book series. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because it was such a grand idea, and the writing in those books was ahead of its time for people, or for women, especially who love romance stories. They were very adventurous, thrilling, a lot of spy intrigue kinds of things. But there was a huge focus in all of Thane's books on the relationships and the characters among the family and among the various heroes and heroines as the series progressed. Well, the way she did this was through generations of these two families and showing how the community developed. And so I would say that the city of Williamsburg was as much character in that series as the people were. And so I loved that idea. I loved that series. I gobbled it up and reread those books multiple times. I own really old copies of those books. And I've always wanted to do something like that. So the opportunity for this series came up and I got the idea. Well, my home area is such a wonderful, rich, historical area. I live in Mobile, Alabama, on the Gulf Coast, and it's 2 hours from New Orleans, 1 hour from Pensacola, Florida. And this whole area was crucial in the settling of the American nation in a lot of different ways. And as I got familiar with the history of the Gulf Coast, I thought, okay, what if I start a series with the French colonials who first came to the Gulf Coast and settled the area, and pick one family and develop that family through the generations of major historical periods. So as I studied the history, I wanted to pick historical events that would have enough depth and meat that my characters would have something to do. And so I could have a thrilling adventure story along with the romances. I can always build a romance in, and I thought it would be really fun to research and find out about these historical events that happened on the Gulf Coast. Well, the first thing that came to light was the story of the Cassette Girls, was what they're sometimes called. Sometimes they're called the Pelican Girls. And the reason they're called the Pelican Girls is because they came from France as mail order brides on a ship called the Pelican. The men that they came to marry were French Canadian settlers who traveled from Canada, Acadia in Canada, which is why the word Acadian morphed into Cajun. That's where that word comes from. And you hear that word all over New Orleans, even to this day. But they were French Canadians, but they were considered Frenchmen. They were considered colonists from the country of France in the early 1700s. So that first book, that's how that first book idea came. And that was the book that I started with. I wrote it first. And pitched it first, sold the series with that book as the grounding. And then as my characters developed, I was looking at the history and I realized that the next major event that happened was after 1711, which was the setting for the Pelican Bride. The next major event was the American Revolution, which is 1770. So that's nearly 75 years later. That's a long time. That's several generations. Well, in the Ellsworth Thane series that I was kind of launching this idea from, she did that as well. She went from American Revolution to Civil War. That's several generations. There was one tie-over character who was the heroine of the first book, became the dying grandmother in the second book. Spoiler alert. Yeah, whatever. So that didn't bother me to skip that many generations. My intent, and this still might happen, was to fill in those gaps at some point and develop the stories of the generational characters in between those first two books. So that's why the major gap. Now, you're asking about this family tree. Another thing that just is a quirk, a reading quirk, personally, I love tie-in characters. If I find a an author that I really, really like. I really enjoy the storytelling. Lois McMaster-Bujold, who is a fantasy writer, comes to mind. I love it when they write a standalone book and then later on tie in a crossover character into stories, or maybe they're a cousin of somebody, or they married so-and-so, or they grew up with so-and-so. That is just really fun. It's kind of an Easter egg thing that people like about series. And so I wanted to do that. If I fell in love with a character as a young person in such and such, in one of my earlier novels, I wanted to see what happened to them when they grew up. So I would write them a story or include them as a character in a later book. So that's why all of those complicated family relationships happened in this series. And some of the characters in this series are actually Easter eggs tied into earlier contemporary stories that I wrote maybe 10 years ago before I developed this series. So all that to say, there is a Lanier family tree on my website. So if you go to my website and look for the books page, on the Pelican Bride book page, there's a link to a PDF of a Lanier family tree so that you can kind of see who's somebody's child, grandchild, all the cousins, who married who. And then I think there's another one that I put on the Magnolia Duchess page, because by then several generations had gone by and I wanted to kind of trace. And as it happens, it's nearly 10 years since I wrote that series, and I've written a lot of books since then, and that tree has branched exponentially over the years, and I've got other little family trees buried different places. I had to dig a little bit to find this one, but it's there. Does that help?
That helps a lot, and that explains. And you can tell when you read the series that you were hitting some major historical events, because you've got your settlement to begin with, and then you're moving to the Revolutionary War, and then you're moving to the War of 1812. So you could see it. I did enjoy watching the families grow and bloom, and it is amazing to me because we kind of grew up, well, my sisters and I, we grew up like 3 hours north of where all of our other family is. So we didn't really have family close. And so I just love the fact that everywhere they turn, it seemed like there was a relative, right? There was a cousin over here and a cousin over there. And so that's just really neat. It's just not something I'm used to as just where we ended up growing up. So I loved it. But with that being said, you said you might consider plugging in some stories in between. We were curious what happened with Amy.
Okay. She was a piece of work and writing, not a particularly likable character to begin with. Mm-mm. And I didn't want to reward her with a happily ever after. So she didn't get one. She did sort of make a turn away from the dark side toward the end, as you probably noticed. But in my brain, and this is sort of hinted at the beginning of Creole Princess, when Lise is talking about her extended family a little bit, and all her mother. Let me see if I made some notes because I had to go. Like I said, I had to go look this up. It's been a minute. She never married. She did have a baby out of wedlock. It's kind of hinted at that she was really thought Bienville, the commander of the settlement, she thought he was mighty cute and very sexy and kind of had her eyes on that, you know, being the wife of the commander. She probably thought she was going to seduce him and marry him. But that never happened. She had a baby out of wedlock I'm hinting that she maybe had an affair with Bienville and had a baby by him, but that's not explicitly stated. So this baby was adopted by her sister, Genevieve, and you all probably read that as Genevieve, which in English it would be, it's a French name, so it's Genevieve. Genevieve and Tristan adopted Aimée's baby and raised her as their own. And then that baby becomes the mother of, she marries a Marc Antoine, one of Marc Antoine's twins. Cousins married all the time back then, not a big deal. And then they had a child who was an ancestress of the Creole princess characters.
Right? There was no blood.
True. That's true. So legally they were cousins, but not really, but not biologically. Correct.
Adopted cousins, yeah. Yeah. Very neat. Okay, so that helps because, you know, when you read that little tidbit in the Creole Princess, you think, oh my goodness, what happened to her?
Yeah.
Well, I figure she's around for a while and kind of in her little Liberty Gibbet, self-centered way, was probably, you know, involved in family politics here and there and trying to stir things up. And eventually she dies and goes away.
Yeah. It's nice as the author to just kind of kill off those pesky characters. So you kind of went through some of our other questions already, but were there any characters or scenes that gave you trouble? Obviously, Amy, you kind of got a little irritated with her, but...
Yeah, one thing, the whole thing was a pain in the neck. I sat with big, thick history books on the table with sticky notes and highlights everywhere to making sure I was staying true to real history and not getting too far off. And I tried, you know, whenever history didn't cooperate with my story, I tried to make a reader note so that you could know what was real and what was, you know, out of Beth White's brain. But one of the things that I wanted to do, and this one, let's jump to the Magnolia Duchess for just a minute, which is the third book in the series. The heroine of that story, Fiona, is a very adventurous young woman. And I thought of that book, I thought of the structure of that book as not only an amnesia story, which I'd never done before, which is kind of interesting, to learn about brain injuries and how amnesia affects your life. But I also thought of it mostly as a Western. I grew up reading Max Brand and Zane Grey Westerns, just loved Gunsmoke, you know, Rifleman, all of those things I grew up with. So I thought of this book as sort of a Western genre, even though it was set during the 1814 at the end of the War of 1812. So that's how I structured it. And so some of the tropes of cowboy hero, adventurous heroine who's ready to grab a rifle and jump on a horse and ride for miles and miles and miles, maybe dress up as a boy. Why not? You know, I just thought it'd be fun. So, but my editor pushed back a little bit when I had Fiona dress up as her cousin and go tend the horses in a war situation dressed as a boy. She just found that a little hard to swallow that a young woman would actually do that. So I had to go back and find examples of young women who actually did dress up as boys and serve in the army in the American Revolution during the Civil War, during the War of 1812. It actually happened. And so once I showed her example, she was like, okay. All right. So then I had to go in and emotionally explain why a sheltered young woman would be so gung-ho, you know, to leave her home behind and go off with a bunch of men to war. Well, story-wise, I wanted her, she had to follow Charlie because he was going to be in New Orleans. He was a British officer and had to be there. And if I left her in Mobile for the rest of the book, that was going to be really boring. So I had to find a way to get her to New Orleans. And once I thought, okay, she's going to dress up. And then all of that created all that other conflict with, is she going to be discovered? What's going to happen when she's discovered? A young girl by herself with all these men, how's that going to work? Mm-hmm. And it was a mess, but I think it worked out.
It did.
I was happy with it.
That's life, right? Life can be very messy, but it works out. So did you have any characters then that surprised you as you wrote the series?
Yes. Back with the Pelican Bride, the first one, Colonial Period, I structured that book And when I talk about the mechanics of structuring a novel, there's a couple of different ways you can handle characters. You can either have a major protagonist who is the only viewpoint all the way through the whole book, and usually that happens when you have a first person story, or you can have, like in a typical romance, so you can have a hero and a heroine, and you kind of switch back and forth between those two points of view, so that you're inside the girl's head for a while, and then you're inside the man's head for a while, and then they clash and conflict and get together and have a happily ever after. That's another one. And then a third structure that I had never really tried before is multiple viewpoint characters, where you're inside the heads of 5 to 7 different characters and seeing the story, and the story progresses through all of those points of view. I'd never done that before because it's very complicated, and the more characters you develop, the longer the book has to be. The Pelican Bride started out to be about 120,000 words, which is like a 500-page tome, and the publisher was not, it was like, we got to cut this down a little bit. So you have to be careful how many characters you throw into the mix, because you have to develop it. You're going to put a character in, they have to be developed. So all that to say, the one that when I decided to do that, it was just different. And I tried it as an experiment, because there was a fantasy series that I had read that did that and ended every chapter, every scene on a cliffhanger, so that you had to wait, you know, 20 or 40 pages to find out what happened to that person. I thought that was kind of cool. So I tried that, maybe successfully, maybe not. I don't know. So, but anyway, the priest character, Father Matthew, intrigued me so much because he was the mentor to the heroine and the hero in different ways. And I didn't know much about Catholicism because I'm Protestant, evangelical Protestant. And I just thought it would be interesting to see if I could find out enough about the Catholic faith and doctrine to actually write a true to life character from that time period. So I tried it, and I just fell in love with Father Matthew. I just thought he was so kind and so full of wisdom, and kind of helped pull my characters out of story jams more than once. Then I get him to the point where he's, okay, bunch of spoiler alerts here, so in case anybody has not read the series, stop now, because I'm fixing to tell you something very drastic. Father Matthew is part of an expedition as an envoy. If I'm remembering the story correctly, I think he's an envoy from the French to the Indians, I believe, because he had developed some relationships with the natives. And he's killed by a renegade. Like, and at the end, I ended a chapter with him seeing the attack coming, falling to his knees and praying, and then he's dead. And so, yeah, that was a surprise. I didn't see that coming, but it was an obvious thing that had to happen, and it completely shifted the trajectory of the story. It shifted all kinds of relationships and questions about God in the minds of my hero and heroine. Yeah, that was probably the most shocking thing that happened.
It is interesting where your characters go sometimes without you intending. At least it wasn't in your initial plan.
Yep.
Did you then have a favorite character or a least favorite character, or one of both?
I love my heroes, especially the ones who are self-deprecating and humorous and don't tend to take things very seriously at first. Charlie's sort of one of those characters in The Magnolia Duchess, but Rafa Gonzalez in The Creole Princess is probably one of my favorite characters I've ever written. I based him off of The Scarlet Pimpernel. Have y'all read The Scarlet Pimpernel by the Baroness Orczy? It was a romance. Man, I didn't look up when it was published, but it's been made into a movie 2 or 3 different times. I think there's a series, maybe Netflix or something has a series. It is such an adventure. It's set during the French Revolution, and it's about a French aristocrat who is smuggling Jacobite religious objectors out of France. They were beheading those people at the time. And this French aristocrat pretends to be this lazy, self-absorbed playboy who can't even get up out of a chair to walk across the room. And he's just so sarcastic, and he's married, and his wife just can't stand him at first because he's so lazy. And then she discovers that he's really this hero who has been smuggling people out of the country to save them. And then, of course, she falls in love with him. So that book gave me the idea for Rafa Gonzalez of Creole Princess. And I made him to be just as silly and goofy and loves clothes, loves adventure, loves drink, loves women, and teases Lee unbearably, you know, at first. And I want you to really, but I tried really hard to make it very clear that he was, that that's not all there was to him. So I just loved developing Rafa. I thought he was hilarious.
Yeah, he was. I enjoyed him. And since we're talking about his story, can you explain a little bit about the pirate treasure and what was going on with that?
Yeah, that story, when I read, let's see, that was War, the American Revolution. That was one about the Spanish gold. Okay, so when I discovered that, recently discovered history that had been the Spanish archives in Barcelona, maybe? There's a archives there that had kept the information that the Spanish had been secretly funding the American Revolution. That had been kept secret for couple of hundred years, and that was recently uncovered. And when I read that in a recent history of the Spanish as involved in the American Revolution, I thought, oh, that is the coolest thing ever. I never knew that. And I bet that would make a cool plot thread that would kind of help tie the story together on the adventure and espionage side. So I had Rafa be one of the things that the Spanish were at that time in control of New Orleans. And the British were in control of Mobile, and the British, I believe, also had Pensacola. So, but the Americans and the British were button heads all over the southern United States at the time. And the British, that's where the British were trying to reinvade. Wait a minute, I'm getting that 1812 wrong. Okay, yeah, okay. So this was when the Americans were trying to break loose from the British for the first time, right? Okay, now I'm getting my history straight. So the Spanish were secretly had a secret treaty with the Americans because they really wanted to get rid of the British. They really wanted to have more influence with this new American nation themselves. In other words, they were putting all their cards, putting all their money on the Americans being able to boot out the British. So there was a shipment of gold that the Spanish king wanted to get from New Orleans into Mobile and then on up the rivers to Fort Pitt, where the Americans' base of operation was. And so Rafa that's his mission, is to get that gold up to Fort Pitt. Well, it gets hijacked by pirates operating along the Gulf Coast, and Lisa's, the heroine's brother, Simon, is one of those pirates. So Simon hijacks the ship, captures the gold, takes it away. He's intending to take it back to New Orleans and trade it for merchandise, which he's going to then sell and make a boatload of money. So Lise discovers that her brother's actually a pirate, and he's actually got the money, and she's kind of horrified, but she doesn't want to give him up, so she doesn't tell anybody. Well, Rafa he's a spy, he's an agent, and he's determined that he's going to get that gold back because it's on him to get it up to the American Revolution people up in the north part of around Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. So he eventually snoops around enough and figures out who the pirate is, confronts him, eventually turns the brother, Simon, toward the American Revolution. He's been kind of a loose cannon, Rafa manages to convince him that the Americans have the right and they're going to be come out on top. Eventually, you might as well join in. Why are you just playing around and being so selfish? And then so the two of them wind up together, taking the gold up to Fort Pitt and leave it there. Yay, the Americans win. And then they come back and the story continues.
I love it. I loved their interaction too, when he was like, pretending to be passed out drunk, but actually spying on them. Pretty entertaining. He was a very entertaining character, though.
Good, thank you. I would agree. That makes me happy.
Talking about characters, I would have to say one of my favorite characters in that book also was Madame Galvez. She was awesome. Like, when she bought Martine to save her just like that, she's like, oh, I'm glad that was okay because that's all I had. Like, she just won my heart so fast.
She was a real person. Galvez was a real person and was apparently a real able administrator, managed to keep control of New Orleans during all that chaos, and married this beautiful woman who was a wonderful hostess. You know, that part about her buying the slave, obviously that was my invention, mm-hmm. but why not? You know, there's not a whole lot known about her except the fact that she was beautiful, she was aristocratic, and she was a great hostess.
Yeah. So what do you hope your readers will get out of reading this series?
Always, my first priority is for the reader to have fun with a great story, with fun characters, with deep characters, with characters that you fall in love with and that you wouldn't mind being their best friend. That's my number one goal. Number two is truth. I get really irritated when there is an agenda behind a book or a story that is really obvious. And I might have some themes that I want to explore, and I might have some deeply held beliefs that undergird the heroes and heroines that I'm writing about. And those deeply held beliefs are obviously going to eventually emerge. But I like to explore all sides of an issue. You know, I don't really write issue books so much as I like to find a place where there's conflict and confrontation and disagreement and discussion and debate. And I found it so interesting, especially in, which one was it? Creole Princess. Where Lisa's father decides that he's going to read the Declaration of Independence in a public bar when there are British officers ready to pounce on anybody proclaiming American independence. That's a thing that really happened. It wasn't my fictional character, but there was a man who got it in a public bar and did that. And it's so interesting to see similar free speech and American values debates and discussions going on in 21st century America, and what happens to people when they stand up and say what they believe and what they believe the truth is and what they've seen with their own eyeballs, whether people like it or not. So truth is number two on my list. It might ought to be number one, but good story and truth, those two things go right there together. And then if I can turn the reader's eyes toward the idea that there is a God who loves us and who wants the best for us, if we will look for him and if we will learn to obey him, if that can be kind of running underneath everything, that makes me really happy without, you know, beating people over the head with it and making that, you know, I don't want that to be a thing itself, but I want that to kind of support and undergird a fun story. So those three
talked about, I think did a really good job with that. When we talked about, we've talked about book one already, The Pelican Bride. And we just said, when we rate the inspiration level, I think we put it at like mocha, cause it's there, but it's so woven into your characters' mm-hmm. lives, how they live out their faith, rather than it being this, like you said, you don't want to beat them over the head, you know, with Bible verses and things like that. So I thought you did a really good job weaving their faith.
Yeah, thanks. That one was an interesting book on a religious level, because I try to have characters from a different doctrinal, even Christian characters from different doctrinal faiths, as well as the Native Americans, and kind of let those things bubble up and be what they were. And people lived that way during that time period. People were very conscious of their relationship with God, with the deity, with the creator of the universe. They went to church, you know, and even if they didn't have a church, they made sure that the church was one of the first things that they built when they were creating a settlement. So yeah, I'm glad that came through, and that was really fun and interesting to develop those things.
Yeah. I have a question. When I was reading the end of your second book, at the end, you have a sneak peek to the third one, but the third one had a different title. So what made you change the title to Magnolia Duchess?
That's a publisher thing. The third book, I had conceived that book actually a long time before I wrote Pelican Bride. The basic idea, I was trying to come up with a Little Mermaid story, you know, in terms of mythical fairy tale type stories. And I set it in Navy Cove, and I wanted to call it The Duchess of Navy Cove. And then when it became part of this Gulf Coast series, they had already named the Pelican Bride. And then they decided the Creole Princess would be, has sort of a, the description, female role, bride, princess. And then they wanted the third one to have a similar sort of a wordy ring to it. So I was happy with Duchess because that had been my original idea. And so the editors, marketing people, Magnolia Duchess. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, Magnolia is the Mississippi flower. It has nothing to do with Alabama people. But, you know, there's a point where you just kind of quit arguing and go, okay, whatever. Fine, Magnolia Duchess, make you happy. Wasn't worth, you know, creating a dust up with my publishing company.
Yeah. So on that note, we do have aspiring authors that I work with that also listen to the podcast. Do you have any advice that you would share with them?
Yeah. sure. Okay. Number one, and I'm preaching to myself here. Okay. Write even when you don't feel like it, when it is not convenient. Find a little corner of time every day, if possible, to write something. And if you can't physically get to your computer and write, then sit in a corner and invent things in your brain. If you want to write, you have to be a writer. And that is a difficult thing to get across to extreme. When you first begin to enjoy writing, it's something that you do because it's just fun, and you may create a scene or two and, oh, that was so cool. And then you get to my granddaughter is going through this. She's 9 or 10, and she's got a little story started, and she got 3 chapters in. And it was like, okay, I don't know what they do next. And at a certain point, you just have to go, well, nobody knows what's going to happen next. You make it up and figure out what's the worst thing that could happen. So bottom line, you just have to do it. You have to sit in a chair, either with a pad of paper and a pen or a computer or an iPad or something, and just put words on the paper. That's number one. Number two, read good books by authors that you admire and do sort of what they do. And as I was talking to you today, name 3 or 4 different authors whose different structural things and series ideas and whatever I've kind of mimicked, because it worked in that situation. I really loved that. So let me try that. That's a good strategy. Then this last one is sort of a personal thing that is kind of, I've woken up to over the course of being a writer and having books published in the public market. And that is just personally be kind. There's no reason to be dismissive and negative to somebody else out loud on purpose for reasons of making yourself look better. That is never going to go well. It may make you feel better to say somebody else's work is less than in the moment, but it's always going to come back to bite you in the behind. It's never a good idea to be unkind in print or verbally. Be humble. Assume the best of people. Those are hard things to do, and those are personal character qualities that I don't always achieve, but I guess I could say I've discovered to my chagrin that when I don't hold to those values, it's never gone well. God has always managed to get me by the hair and go, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And I have to go, okay, yeah, I repent. I'm sorry. I'm not ever doing that again. So if you're a Christian writer, just beware that that's going to happen.
I would agree. I found that most authors are willing to be collaborative and not competitive, because there's room for all of us out there. And we all have this unique voice. So though you and I might write in the same genre, but it's not the same. And so we're not really competing with each other. We're kind of helping each other along. So
yeah,
that was wonderful advice.
Yeah.
Good.
So how can our listeners then connect with you further?
Well, I do have a website still. It hadn't been updated a whole lot in a while. I'm kind of in a somewhat of a fallow period right now. I'm developing a new series that's pretty complicated and dense and is requiring a lot of research. And so I'm kind of holding off revamping my website until I get that series launched. But it is still there, and there's still basic information about me and my books. Everything's listed there. There's a blog there, and there's a contact button there. So if anybody, I'm in a place right now, I just retired from teaching high school. So I have a little more time on my hands now to do those kinds of things. So if anybody would like to reach out to me and ask a question, I'm perfectly willing to do that. You can just reach me through the contact button. I have a Facebook page, an author Facebook page, and an Instagram, author Beth White on Instagram. And I'm not there a whole lot right now. I just have become a little more private lately. Not a total hermit. I'm there occasionally, but I just don't post about myself a whole lot anymore. And my husband, you need to market your books. Why did you write these books if you're not going to market them? Good question. I don't know. Anyway, so website, bethwhite.com.
Wonderful. And congratulations on your retirement. That is exciting. Yeah.
Yes, I miss teenagers and I miss teaching music, but I don't miss the public school carnival, as yeah. It was.
So I'm still in the trenches.
Oh, God bless you.
So I understand what you're saying, but
yeah.
Congratulations. And thank you for your time in the classroom, too.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Beth. It was a blast to connect with you again. And maybe once you get that next series up, we'll have you back on the podcast.
Thank you. I'll let you know. It's coming. It's just very slow.
Yes, I understand. Well, I know we can tell by your writing, you put a lot into your research. It shows. So, and it just makes the story come to life. So mm-hmm. Thank you for putting that time into it.
Thanks. At some point you kind of have to let that go and just do the best you can. So I'm having a hard time with that right now, but it'll happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, Beth. And like I said, we'll probably catch you again soon.
All right. Thank you for good questions. And thank you for the opportunity to interact with you ladies. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, please consider signing up for our free newsletter. Each week, you'll receive news about our events for both readers and authors, plus updates on my books. You can sign up at literaryscape.com/newsletter. Until next time, happy and blessed reading and writing.